There was something particularly cloying about some mud. Perhaps the chalk in the subsoil gave it a gummy quality like half-dried cement, which made the going even worse than in the porridgey mud of Flanders. Oh, we were experts in mud. A light railway had been engineered across the battlefield from Albert to the highest contour, above the wood which lay in a slight hollow. And if you took this toy train up to the height of the land, the Somme country lay around you like a map. Behind was the pretty valley of the Onc, still showing some winter verdure. And there stood the Albert Basilica against the sky, with its huge gilt Madonna knocked sideways by a shell. Right and left ran the ridge from Delville Wood to Highwood, where my brother Christopher had been killed in October. From Highwood to Poisiers, from Poisiers to the hill above Teepvale, the watershed which had been the original objective for the 1st of July, the starting point from which we were to have exploited the victory that was never won. Carrying the eye round from Poisiers, I could see Ovillers, where we had fought two battles in July and August, now deserted by a host that had moved on. The countryside looked as if a tidal wave had flowed over it. You could see 10 or a dozen villages, all with names still remembered by old soldiers, and not one with a house or barn standing. There might be a spike of brickwork where the church had been, or not even that, merely mounds of rubble and discoloured soil. Hedgerows looked deader than they need in November, and woods were clusters of bare poles. The tall poplars, in which the French delight, were stripped of their side branches, their foliage scorched, trunks snapped off short with splintered ends like monstrous shaving brushes. Every yard of ground had been ploughed up by shellfire and was tainted with high explosives, so that a chemical reek pervaded the air. The smell of burnt and poisoned mud, acrid is, I think, the right word, was with us for months on end, and through it one could distinguish a more biotic flavour, the stink of corrupting human flesh. In the 30 square miles around us, the best part of 200,000 men had been killed in the last few months and had laid unburied, or been buried hastily in shallow graves, or buried and blown out of their graves again. I think 7,000 corpses to the square mile is not much of an exaggeration. 10 to the acre, shall we say, and your nose told you where they lay thickest. These are the words, once again, as we heard last week, from Charles Carrington, a young 19-year-old officer serving with the Royal Warwickshire Regiment. He's, as we found out last week, taken part in hand-to-hand fighting in the village of Ovillers. And now that battle is over, the summer has gone, the battle has moved on eastwards, slowly inching its way towards Bapaume. Bapaume, that town that was supposed to be reached on the first day, which still lay out of reach, which was to remain out of reach until the Germans withdrew in the following spring. Welcome once again to the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields. Last week we told the first part of Charles Edmund's story, but we ran out of time. I ran out of time because I rambled on so much. Because I don't know about you, but I was enjoying the words in his book, A Subaltern's War. And now, in this second episode, we take the story on to another stage. Into that autumn and winter of 1916, Carrington, as I mentioned last week, wrote the first book, A Subaltern's War, under pseudonym Charles Edmonds. But decades later, he wrote another book, Soldier from the War's Returning, and wrote it under his real name of Charles Carrington, and it was from that book that I was quoting just now. And he goes on a bit more. He says, after a battle, you buried your comrades and saw to it their graves were marked with a wooden cross and a name. If you had time and it was not too dangerous, you did as much for other British dead. The enemy came last in priority, and more than once I've cleared a trench of its defunct tenants by throwing them over the parapet where someone might or might not find them and bury them when the battle was over. There were so many live inhabitants in the landscape as I saw it at Contalmaison in November 1916 that corpses had been cleared off everyone's premises unless you went up to the new front where it was too dangerous for burial parties to work. But in rolling forward, the armies left deserts behind, and where no one had either need nor inclination to go, in winter dreary beyond description, inhabited only by giant rats fattened on corpse flesh, in summer strangely beautiful with carpets of wild flowers and loud with skylarks. Clumps of scarlet poppies sprang up wherever the chalky subsoil had been disturbed by digging or by shell fire. Long afterwards, you could find corpses in nooks and corners of this wilderness, as I found one at La Boisselle in 1921. When I was a boy, I was very superstitious, suffered from creepy feelings when I was alone, and was afraid of the dark. This nonsense was completely obliterated by the genuine horrors of the battlefield, and I remember surprise at my own unconcern. I never heard a ghost story at the front. As I'm reading that, I'm thinking of my visits to that very area, the lovely little village of Contalmaison, the fields that surround Poisier and La Boisselle, and now returned to their previous use of arable farming, even during the busy months when tourists go to the Somme, maybe in July to remember the first day of the battle, or in November to remember the armistice. You can walk those fields and not see a soul until you get to places like the Tietvau Memorial or the Lochnagar Crater. That's where people tend to congregate. Of course they do. Makes sense, doesn't it? But those fields, those silent fields now, where those poppies still grow, they've got their own story to tell, a story that Carrington is telling us. And along that main road, from Albert to Bapaume, is the Butte de Wallencourt, now owned by friends of the podcast, Terry Berry and Rick Smith, and what grand work they're doing there. It's a lovely place now to see the battlefield from up there. You can see for miles on a clear day up to Tietvau and to the south. But Carrington was there, and he describes the horror of the area around the Butte de Wallencourt in the book, his book, A Subaltern's War. He says, down in the bottom, in the central middle distance, there rose out of the mud a strange conical mound of white chalk, 100 feet high. It was once known as the Butte de Wallencourt and marked the German front line, while the artillery of the two armies lay back on the hilltop, strafing anyone who moved by day down in the long slopes to the butte. The infantry crouched and hid in the mud at the valley bottom. Even by night, one could scarcely move, for the enemy spasmodically plastered with shellfire every line of approach. To go or come from the line was a nightmare adventure, and once there, one dared not move for fear of the enemy machine guns on the Butte de Wallencourt. That ghastly hill, never free from the smoke of bursting shells, became fabulous. It shone white in the night and seemed to leer at you like an ogre in a fairy tale. It loomed up unexpectedly, peering into trenches where you thought yourself safe. It haunted your dreams. 24 hours in the trenches before the boot finished a man off. Now, in the book, Subaltern's War, all of the characters in there, he changed their names, so we don't know who they are, we don't know who they were, and we don't know the three men that died, where they're buried, if they are buried. But he doesn't do that in Soldiers from the War Returning. He talks about soldiers with their real names. And one of them, he described a man called Oliver Sichel, S-I-C-H-E-L. He said he was older than me and senior in rank, and he'd just come out with a draft of reinforcements and was attached to my company for instruction. And this was his first visit to the trenches. I was acting just then as a company commander, and it was my duty to induct him in command of a forward post, actually the most forward post of the British Army. Oliver was a literary man, a comfortable figure who managed to look well-dressed even in trench kit. Oh well, I can't say more, but I can't forget his face as I planted him in for the December night, ankle deep in slime, exposed to the gunfire and the rain. "Is this it?" his eyes mutely asked me. "Is this what I am to expect?" How unlike my own initiation at Gommacourt Wood a year ago. How far away was that early enthusiasm? And then there's a footnote at the bottom of the page, and it tells us that Oliver went on to serve as an officer with the 2nd 6th Royal Warwickshire Battalion, where just 3 weeks before the end of the Great War on the 25th of October 1918, he was killed in action. And as I always do, I became intrigued by this man and decided to find out a little bit more about him. Charles's mate, Oliver. So as usual, the first thing I did was to turn to the Commonwealth War Graves Commission website. And it tells us that he was 26 years old. He'd been mentioned in dispatches, and he was the son of Walter and Constance. They lived at number 50 Egerton Gardens in South Kensington in London. And he's buried in a cemetery that I can't pronounce very well. I've been there and I still can't pronounce it. I think it's pronounced Awongt. A-W O-I-N-G-T, British Cemetery. And the personal inscription that his parents chose for him is a quote for some music. "They shall mount up with wings as eagles, thy spirit dear, the soul of music." That gives us an insight into this man's life. A life that was cut short at the age of just 26. His death was reported in the Illustrated Sporting and Dramatic News, a publication that I've not come across before. There's a great photograph of him that tells us he died of wounds. And I'll put a copy of that photograph on the podcast page of my website, terrystours.co.uk. The article tells us that he died at a casualty clearing station of wounds received in action on the previous day. And when at Harrow, he was captain of the House Football 11 and a prominent member of the school football 11. He was also in the House Cricket 11, and he distinguished himself in all sports. Harrovians of his time will also remember his gifts of song and music and the charm of his personality. And I found even more detailed information about him on the Harrow School World War One memorial page. And it tells us that his mother, Constance, her father, had been a Member of Parliament for Hackney and a member of Gladstone's government, and that Oliver himself had won a prize for singing at Harrow School that his father had introduced, and that he was in business in Manchester. It said he joined the Inns of Court, the Officers Training Corps, on the outbreak of war, and was gazetted in June of 1915. He was invalided home during August of 1917, and then offered an instructorship, but he refused it and returned to France in January of 1918. In the retreat of March 1918, he commanded a pioneer battalion with marked success. He came home on leave in August 1918, and once again refused the offer of an appointment back home because he wanted to return to the front. And on the 24th of October 1918, he was leading an attack on a village, and by this time, of course, as we know, it's open warfare. There's very few trenches. It says he was marching ahead with a Lewis gun section when unexpectedly a strong enemy artillery fire arose. He at once sent the men back with all military papers and pressed on with four men to the western outskirts of the village. He was then badly wounded and left in a house which was subsequently occupied by the Germans. Three attempts were made to rescue him, but it was not until he'd been there for 14 hours that a counter-attack succeeded in recapturing part of the village in which he was lying. He was taken back to a casualty clearing station where he died the next day. His commanding officer wrote this letter to his father. He said, "Your son was immensely popular with all ranks in the battalion, and this was evidenced by the many gallant efforts made to get him back during the day. In the morning of the 24th, Oliver led his men with the utmost dash and gallantry. Had he lived, he would undoubtedly have received the just reward for such gallantry. So yet again, we see a very talented young man, a talented sportsman, a talented musician. What would he have achieved in his life had he lived? But he didn't live. He was taken by the Great War in 1918. Now, another subject that I want to research and talk about in another podcast is the German withdrawal from the Somme battlefield in the spring of 1917. And we get a little insight into that from Carrington himself. He says that both armies were physically and morally exhausted after the Somme fighting and the hard winter. The main German forces had gone when we moved forward, having burnt every house, blown up every church, public building and ancient monument, broken every bridge and culvert, mined every crossroads and polluted every well. They'd carried away all the able-bodied men and women into captivity, leaving the old and feeble concentrated in one or two villages, and, which seemed to distress the French most, they'd even found time to ringbark the apple trees in the cider orchards. The country was dead, laid waste with a destructive fervour, worse than anything in the 30 Years' War, a devastation that had no parallel since the War of the Mongols. When we marched into Peronne, the houses in the marketplace were blown down, the fires were still burning in the church, the old castle and the public library, we saw a huge notice erected on the town hall in German, which translated said, "Don't be angry, only wonder." Indeed, it puzzled us a good deal. We were not angry, but delighted that a large region of France should be liberated. And if we had any astonishment left, it was at the ingenuities of German barbarism. What they had not destroyed, they had defiled. And when one found a house or room unburned, it looked as if it had been visited by a gang of those delinquent teenagers whose vandalism is reported from time to time in our newspapers. In those days, we were less advanced in social decadence and could still be shocked. It is the first step that matters in the easy descent to hell. He then goes on to detail what I think we've all heard about, and that is that the Germans left booby traps behind to trap the advancing Allies. He says, "On the first day, we lost two officers from my mess. One was shot by a German sniper when leading the advance guard, and the other was caught by a booby trap. In a German dugout, he'd sat down in a chair and drawn it up to the table, thus igniting the fuse of a concealed bomb with its starting mechanism tied to the chair leg. We'd been warned and an order was given that no other ranks were to be allowed into any house or dugout until an officer had searched it for booby traps." And then he talks about life, really, of an average British or Allied soldier, Commonwealth soldier, I suppose, in the Great War. What went on when they weren't in battle? So far, we've heard about what happens when you come face to face with the enemy and the horror of that situation. But that's only a small part, as we know, of the soldiers' experience in the Great War. And Carrington explains to us what it was like to be on the march. Of course, the British used vehicles as best they could to move soldiers around, to move armies around. They used trains as well. But so much of it was done by foot, on the march, as he calls it. He says, "In the half-light of crowds of men pull on their boots, wind their putties as if they were winding bandages, shave in their shirt sleeves if there happens to be any water, and clean their rifles, whatever and wherever the situation. There is not much time for breakfast because everything must be packed, the blankets rolled and carted, billets cleaned and fatigues done before we can march off. Those who cannot march must be sent to the medical officer's sick parade at the dressing station, and what he will do with them, well, God knows. Perhaps 2 hours after Reveille, the companies are on parade. If there's time, the turnout will be inspected by company officers, and time must be found for rifle inspection, on which lives depend. Now we march to the rendezvous, which may be a mile or more away, so that another half hour will be needed before the column is formed on the main road. The morning is fine. We're all in good spirits and think nothing of the weight of our packs. Every man has his personal property on his back, a rifle on his shoulder. bayonet and entrenching tool at his side, and 100 rounds of ammunition in pouches strapped to his chest. In his pack is the iron ration, the emergency reserve of bully beef and biscuits which soldiers carry but must never be touched. Only once in war do I remember orders coming down that we were to live on our iron rations for the day, and it seemed like sacrilege. We also carry a quart of water in a covered flask, and this too may be drunk only with permission. Sometimes there's a blanket to be rolled over the pack, or an additional bandolier of ammunition, and this is hell. We step off briskly at a steady pace, which by its rhythm becomes automatic, almost hypnotic. On a good ground, exactly 30 inches to the pace, exactly 108 paces to the minute, give you 3 miles to the hour, or 2 miles and an hour and a half, because 10 minutes rest are allowed in every 60. Whether you've been marching for 50 minutes or only for 5, the whistle blows at 10 minutes to the hour. Companies are halted and everyone falls out on the right side of the road. Sit down, stretch your legs, put your feet up if you can, on a stroke of the hour, fall in by companies and march on. I often think about this. Since 2014, I've been involved, as a lot of you will know, with the Army Benevolent Fund, and we do this frontline walk every year. And I'm not sure, I've done it 8 or 9 times, something like that. 60 miles we go, or 100 kilometres over 3 days across the battlefields of the Somme, of Arras, of Vimy Ridge, and we end up at the Menin Gate in Ypres. And we do that with modern equipment, good walking boots, lots of water, rest stops, food, energy drinks to keep us going. And believe me, at the end of each day, you are absolutely exhausted and you know you've got another day to go. But you keep going because you're doing this for the Soldiers Charity. And I remember in 2018, we did a walk following the British Army during the final 100 days, and we ended up in Mons. And a lot of that, we walked along disused railway tracks with the ballast there, the gravel. And that's exactly what the British Tommy did in 1914 when they were retreating from the rampaging German army, and what they did again in 1918. And it felt like daggers were digging into your feet, even with these well-protected modern boots we were wearing. And our minds all went back to those men from the Great War doing exactly the same. Just as Carrington says here, the column starts with correct drill movements, marching at attention. As soon as the rhythm is established and the human caterpillar acquires momentum, the word is passed back to march at ease. Men sling their rifles, open their coat collars, tilt back their caps. That's as if we were lucky enough not to be wearing helmets, and they become human again from the waist up. Talking is allowed, and friends look over their shoulder to exchange a word with friends in the rank behind. A blue cloud of tobacco rises and thickens, and before long someone begins to whistle, like the soldiers in the film of the River Kwai. Don't forget that he's written his book in the 1960s, by which time that famous film has come out. This whistling the sergeants encourage because it maintains the rhythm and ensures that the men still behave automatically from the waist down. If we sing on the march in the morning, the songs are gay and ribald, and it's more likely that the company humorist has composed some topical verses, so that the song about the idiosyncrasies of the colonel. The nearest officer pretends not to hear while he concentrates on memorising it so he can give a spirited rendering of it in the mess that evening. Just when the language grows a little too free and the officer is wondering whether to take notice of it, the word comes down the column. March at attention! We're passing through a village where another regiment has its headquarters. This is our display of pride, our publicity, and we are ready to show them what good soldiers look like. If their guard is slack or untidy, it is not only the colonel and the sergeant major who will take notice. The company humorist has seen it too, and is already improvising a new verse about this pretty rotten lot. That just shows the pride that each man has within his own battalion, within his own company. They're trying to be better than the next lot. That's human nature, isn't it? The day wears on. Three spells of marching have brought us 7 or 8 miles and we halt for our dinners. A battalion of 800 men makes a column of 1/4 mile long, not counting the transport, 16 limbered wagons and 2 smaller vehicles, which trail behind. All these are loaded to overflowing with the official stores of the battalion and with everything that the quartermaster has been able to scrounge in addition. With the transport are 4 cooking stoves on wheels, the field kitchens in which dinners are being stewed in dixies as we go along. Behind them march the company cooks, stoking or stirring as they go, the only men in the battalion whose clothes can never, by any force of discipline, be kept clean. At midday, halt, the cookers come trundling up from the rear and are greeted with cheers. We know that, don't we? An army marches on its stomach. We've been told that so many times, and this is evidence here. Again, the orderlies for the day are called out. The dixies, now full of stew, are carried to platoons while the men line up to fill their mess tin, and each produces his own knife and fork. There may be green vegetables in the stew, and there may be 1/2 loaf of bread for each man, or 2 between 5, and what is left he'll keep for his tea. Every officer sees that his men are fed before going to his own mess, a picnic party sat out under a tree by the officer's servants. And then after food, it's time to march again. And Carrington tells us that the optimists and the moral raisers of all ranks start up a song to keep things going. And he says that one of the songs that they sing as they march along is called "There's a Long, Long Trail A-Winding." So just imagine, if you can, in your mind's eye, a whole battalion of men marching along down those sunken lanes on the Somme behind the lines on the other battlefields, laughing and joking with their mates, perhaps thinking about their mates that are no longer with them. And of course they're fearing for the future. They're wondering where they're marching to and when their next action will take place, or when perhaps they'll come into contact with German enemy artillery. And you've got to find a way of passing the time, haven't you? You've got to find a way of taking away the pain that you feel in your boots and your feet. So imagine, if you can, as they walked along singing this song. But despite their singing and their high hopes, their motivation, the road surface is or seems worse, he says, so that march discipline falters. The sergeant major yelps his left, right in vain, and officious subalterns stepping out of the column to cruise up and down, looking for the weaker brothers, make less impact. No one now cares, and only tea and billets ahead draw the men forward. At the rear, a new phenomenon occurs. Every check in front, the column draws out like elastic, so the pace seems to vary. In front, they are marching steadily and keeping time. Behind, they are breaking into a run to make up lost ground. Mounted officers ride back, making themselves unpopular by splashing the foot sloggers, who envy them as they pass, but nothing can prevent this tendency. While the rear, which has hurried to catch up, must now hurry again to keep up. That man who reported sick this morning but was sent by the doctors to light duty looks as if he's going to faint. Though his mate on one side carries his rifle and his mate on the other holds his arm, he breaks step and throws everyone behind him out of step. Left, right, bellows the sergeant. Pick it up there. The subaltern, not so heavily loaded as his men, carries someone's rifle. At a bravado, he carries two rifles. Everyone consults to get the sick man along because falling out on the march is a military offence as well as a disgrace to the platoon. If he falls out, what will become of him? When at last we reach the billeting area in the dusk, no one notices that our rifles just slide off our shoulders as we order arms. 6 hours marching has brought us only 15 miles, but we were up 2 hours before the march began, and there is much more to be done now we have arrived. And then it's time to rest. When the soldiers get their boots off, he says, and putties off and snuggle down in the straw, with one or two candle ends to light a barnful, they even begin to sing again. Very sentimental songs, a bit like this. I'm not going to try and sing it, I'll just read the words. Take me over the sea, where the Alamanes can't get at me. Oh my, I don't want to die, I want to go home. But he says that even this is not the end of the day. The men are routed out to wash and tend their feet, pricking blisters and rubbing in oil before the foot inspection by an officer. If a man goes lame through neglecting his feet, he'll be put on a charge as certainly as if his rifle were dirty. And after foot inspection, if it was a lucky day, came the rum issue. In a good regiment, the rum, in its jars of earthenware, is always kept under the care of an officer and is given out in strict allowance and only in his presence. The orderly officer visits all the billets in turn and a sergeant carrying the jar. Some men pour it into their tea, but most take their tot in an enamelled mug and toss it down with a "Good health, sir!" It's strong enough to bring tears to a recruit's eye. Rum issue is a privileged occasion, he says, and no one minds that the end of the queue is singing a parody of the tear-jerking song of Gertie Gitanas.
If the sergeant steals your rum, never mind. If the sergeant steals your rum, never mind. Though he's just a bloody sot, you must let him have the lot. If the sergeant steals your rum, never mind.
Oh, never mind.
If old Jerry bombs the trench, never mind. If old Jerry bombs the trench, never mind. And though the sandbags fly, you have only once to die. If old Jerry bombs the trench, never mind.
Oh, never mind.
Now, in Carrington's book, Soldiers from the War Returning, he calls the chapter Some Random Recollections, when he was talking about marching. And he also talks about one of the least popular activities that an officer has to do, and that's censoring the letters of the men beneath them. He said, in the evenings, all officers had a task to do, whether in rest billets or in the line, the centering of letters. At the base, there was a staff of security officers who sampled all correspondence, destroying letters which revealed military secrets, blacking out indiscreet phrases, and occasionally taking steps to punish babblers. Assuming that every unit maintained its own security, the censors merely exercised a general supervision. Letters from the front, which travelled unstamped and post-free, were of three different kinds. At critical times, when a movement was afoot that must at all costs be kept secret, no correspondence was allowed except for filled postcards, bearing a printed formula in which you strike out the sentences that you did not want. And then in brackets he says the options were, I'm quite well, I'm coming home on leave, and I have been wounded, etc. In very quiet times, as a privilege, a ration of green envelopes was issued at the rate of one or two a week. The writer signed a certificate on the green envelope that it contained no military secrets and it was then subject only to the selective censorship at the base. Between the stringency of the field postcard and laxity of the green envelope lay the common form of regimental censorship. Every ordinary letter had to bear the signature of an officer who was then responsible if the base censors discovered a breach of security. Accordingly, letters were read and countersigned by the company officers before they were dispatched, and in retrospect, this seems one of the most intolerable intrusions into privacy that the military life demanded. It was also a great burden to the company's officers to read 100 ill-written letters every evening. Ill-written, I say, but I'm inclined to think that in those days when the compulsory school leaving age was 12, and when almost all who attained a secondary education were officers, handwriting was better and composition no worse than amongst those who leave school at 14 or 15 today. Naturally enough, the knowledge that your letter would be read by your platoon commander put some restraint on your literary style. Although not always, as we sat round the dugout table reading piles of letters by the light of one candle end, we got to know our men with a new intimacy, not because they opened their hearts in letters which would be so public, but because they revealed their characters. Whatever else, this sharing of privacy tightened the bond between officers and men. Of course, if there were no green envelopes and a reliable man came to me with a letter in which he wanted to be private, I would sign it unread. We can get so much information, can't we, from letters that were sent home from the soldiers at the front. Quite often they talk about the weather and their mates and what's happening in their lives, but without going into too much detail about their fears and anxieties, because they don't want to frighten the people at home. A lot of those letters have survived, and we do feature them quite often on this podcast, but what doesn't exist in such great detail is correspondence that went the other way from the people at home out to the soldiers in the trenches. And someone once told me it's because the soldiers were lacking one item in the trenches that they needed perhaps more than most other things. They're not cigarettes or bully beef, but toilet roll. And that's why we don't have many of those letters that they received, because they put them to good use in the latrines. Now, there's more to come from Charles Carrington. In both books, he then goes on to talk about his experiences at Passchendaele in 1917, and that will be the third episode about him in a few weeks' time. But before we go, I just wanted to tell one more story that I came across last week when I was guiding over in Normandy. Before we went to the Normandy beaches, we visited Dieppe, the scene of that catastrophic raid mainly by Canadian soldiers in August of 1942. And we went to see where most of those 1,200 men that died in the Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery on the edge of the town. And whilst we were wandering round the headstones, I found one that related to a woman. And she was a member of the Salvation Army. And although she died in 1940, her and her husband had served on the Western Front in the Great War. If you go to Ypres, go out towards Essex Farm and the Duhailau ADS Cemetery, there's a modern roundabout. And of course, with all these roundabouts, these junctions were crossroads during the First World War. And that roundabout that I just mentioned was known as Salvation Corner. And that's because there was a Salvation Army hut that stood there during the war. H.A. Taylor wrote a book, Goodbye to the Battlefields, and in that he said here in the old days, much depended upon which way you turned. You might wheel and avoid the hazards of a shell-stricken city. Thus came the name. If you're unfortunate in your orders, you went on, skirting the city proper, to Hellfire Corner. And in the magazine, 20 years after, one correspondent wrote, at the corner of the road, there stands an inn. Early as it is in the forenoon, a man enters and orders beer, and what good lady behind the zinc-lined bar recants the liquid from a very large tall bottle into a very small squat glass He indicates the crossroads and says inquiringly, "Salvation Corner." The lady behind the bar confirms that it is that such place. And I wonder whether the lady beneath the headstone that I found in Dieppe Cemetery served there, issuing tea and other comforts to the soldiers as they made their way past. Because, as I say, she was killed in June of 1940 during the retreat to Dunkirk. And I found a newspaper article that tells us all about her. Her name was Mary Jane Climpson. And the newspaper says that she formerly came from Newcastle-upon-Tyne in the northeast. And her husband was Brigadier Herbert Climpson, who was the Army's, in the Second World War, Deputy Director of War Services, and that she was killed by a bomb and she was the first woman to die on service with the BEF. The paper says her romantic story has been told to them partly by her husband, who was visiting his wife's relatives in Newcastle during the week, and partly by her woman friends and colleagues. She was a native of Carlisle, one of three children, but she lost her father when she was just 4 years old. Her young, widowed mother was unable to bring up her family, and she was sent to Newcastle to live with her uncle and aunt. She had little schooling. Much of her time was spent in helping her aunt with household duties. She did have a job for a short time, but it was the need to carry out those domestic duties that ended her business life. Now, Mrs. Climpson became a Salvation Army officer in 1907 after studying at the training college where her future husband was also a student, and they got married in May 1911. And it was then that they went off to France and Belgium to serve in the Great War. They spent nearly 7.5 years in Japan after the war. They experienced typhoons, floods, fires, and the terrible 1923 Tokyo earthquake. Now, when the Second World War came round, they went out to France in September of 1939, and a widow, Brigadier Climpson, said, "We were amongst the pioneer party, with our headquarters at a hostel that had been continuously in operation since the last war as a centre for visitors to the battlefields and war graves. We were getting along magnificently. The British soldiers among we worked were magnificent. After the men had gone up to the front line, pencil notes would come back telling of their gratitude for my wife that they called Mother C. Sometimes they picked flowers from the fields, pressed them and sent them to dear Mother C as a memento. Her death, when a bomb fell by the car in which we were travelling, was a grievous blow to all. For me, it ended a wonderful companionship, but I am borne up by the knowledge that she has passed on in one way she would prefer to go among the boys with whom it was her delight to serve. I'm grateful for the fact that while a bomb took her, she didn't suffer. I'm grateful for 29 years and 4 days of intense happiness. In these war days, we hear of soldiers' wives becoming widows only a few days after they've been married, so I feel I cannot grumble. I am grateful too for the opportunity of carrying on the work which has been our joint responsibility in high service." More details of the heroic end of Mrs. Climpson came in a tribute paid by Mrs. Carpenter, wife of the General of the Salvation Army, who a few days before her death was chatting with Mrs. Climpson at a post in France. "One morning," said Mrs. Carpenter, "the order came that the Salvation Army officers to evacuate all centres toward the front line. Having seen to the safety of all our officers and workers within reach, Brigadier and Mrs. Climpson, with one or two others, headed for the coast. Presently came the drone of aircraft, then the sound of bursting bombs. Alighting from the car, the officers flung themselves on their faces in a field. There was no cry, but when the aircraft had passed and Brigadier Climpson turned to speak to his wife, he found she had heard another voice. A great wound between her slender shoulders told of the hurt from a bomb splinter. The Brigadier told me, I looked up and thought of the boys operating the aeroplane. I felt sorry for them. Later came the funeral. There was neither time nor opportunity to provide a coffin. The dear body was wrapped in a wool blanket. Reverently they laid her amongst soldier boys in whose service she'd given her life." I don't know about you, but it always amazes me when I find stories of people like Mary Jane and her husband. They needn't have been on the Western Front in 1914 to 1918. They needn't have been on the Western Front again in 1939 into 1940. And that was a decision that was to cost her life. She really is a tale from the battlefield, and just leaves me to say thank you very much for taking the effort to listen to me in the podcast, and please do rate and review wherever you get the podcast from. And next week, we'll be commemorating the 110th anniversary of the Battle of Loos, and we'll do that by looking at the story of the 8th Battalion of the Lincolnshires, one of Kitchener's volunteer battalions, and I'll be seeking the help of an author, historian and battlefield guide, Nigel Atter. He's going to come on and tell us what happened, not just to the battalion, but to his own great-great-grandfather who was there. That's next week. But until then, we'll play The Last Post in memory of Mrs. Climpson of the Salvation Army. And as well as being grateful for the words given to us by Charles Carrington, I'd like to dedicate this week's podcast in memory of Mary Jane Climpson.